Welcome to the Highly Objective Podcast, where we talk to cannabis industry executives and investors and go into the weeds on recent news.
My name is Colin Ethery, and I'm the CEO at Samson Extracts currently. We are a large hemp manufacturer in the state of Alabama, more specifically in Southeast Alabama. And we focus really on large-scale production of hemp manufacturing. And really, we focus on CBD at its core, not at what you'd see in a standard extraction lab and regulated cannabis, but really large-scale, large equipment, and large output. Prior to coming here at Samson to help run this operation and get things moving, I operated as the GM and Director of Operations of High Life Farms in Chesaning, Michigan, the first licensed marijuana licensee in that state. And we did a lot of good there. We did cultivation, massive amounts of production, upwards of 400,000 package units a month of edibles, gummies, chocolates, mints, pre-rolls, concentrates, flower, kind of the whole nine yards there. It's focused on just being a massive manufacturer there in the state of Michigan. That we did have the opportunity to be featured on Canacribs when we were at High Life Farms, so that was nice. So some people got to see, what we did from a production perspective there. But that was really my first role in cannabis, because prior to that, I was the chief of staff of a large department at Southwest Airlines, where I focused a lot on departmental operations, technology projects, typical organizational structure and factors there. So did a number of things at Southwest. And prior to that, I had my nerdy career at PwC, where I was in advisory consulting and people and operations, with most of that in oil and gas and aviation. And then prior to that, I worked on the Deepwater Horizon economic class action settlement, which is also known as the BP oil spill, as an intermediary between the claimants and counsel, working through the federal government to make sure that claims were being paid properly, and also performing fraud investigations on any suspect claims. So career's been a little all over the place, but since 2019, I've been heavily operating here in the cannabis space to date.
Yeah, no, I was going to comment on that, going from, kind of fraud, waste, and abuse management program, managing that, going to an accounting firm and really focusing on the advisory side, aviation, airlines, and then really jumping into, cannabis. And then from there, now CBD, which, pretty much are similar to each other, but still very different kind of four industries you've had and very different roles you've had at these companies. So with that background that's so diverse, what has really helped you in where you're at today with Samson, and sort of, what lessons you take from some of your previous stops?
Yeah, I mean, the big one is that, I sometimes get, if you look at my resume, some people would see that I may have had a history of doing job hopping or things like that. But that wasn't really the case. As I started my professional career, I was always willing to take professional risks. I never had a mentality of I need to stay close to home, I only want to do this thing. And kind of the way it went is, I always loved new opportunities. And when I felt like I wasn't being challenged, or my knowledge gain or level of experience gain was being capped, always got a little squirrely, because especially younger in my career, I was like, I need to keep learning more. So I was always took a few more risks to move to a different option or a different industry. And that was certainly the case moving to cannabis. I had a good resume with a high position at Southwest Airlines. And I definitely had to think 10 or 15 times, because cannabis is very cool here now, and you see a lot of people coming into the industry. But in 2019, it felt very risky at that time, but I decided to do it, and it's worked out really well. But the big one, going through and how some of the previous experiences I had prior to cannabis, and I actually have a presentation that I would do at conferences about this, and I don't know if people like it or not, but the biggest one is that cannabis isn't really so different from other industries. And I think whether you're in the industry or you're a watcher of the industry, it's always this mastercraft mystery, like things are done differently, but it's way more similar to normal industry than I would say that it's different. It certainly has like a weird mystique because of what it is, but much like all the other industries, there's inputs and outputs. There's a process that converts that process, and you have to look at it the same way you do other industries. there is a balance there that you have to have business disciplines that you'd have in the other ones. And I would say the other piece that's hugely translated, whether it's at the oil spill, PwC, or even at Southwest, I've generally worked in fairly highly regulated industries for the most part. And everyone thinks cannabis is super regulated. There's this heavy level of regulation. Well, go work at an airliner for 2 or 3 years and tell me if you think cannabis is super regulated. So I've had experience in high regulated industries. And so for me, I was really used to the regulation that I think so many people bark about or complain about. I think it's an appropriate level of regulation. Do some states do things differently than others? Certainly. But it's there for a reason because you have to create consumer confidence, and it's especially important to have a decent amount of regulation at the beginning so that you can set standards and habits moving forward. But really, when I all boil it down, is it's really not so different. You know, there's definitely different knowledge that you have to understand. But here's one thing I will say that is different for cannabis between the two is that you can't be all business. You know, that's one lesson I've learned in cannabis is you can't be robotic. You have to have a healthy blend of those that understand the discipline and the principles of business, but you also have to have a blend of those that are lovers of the plant. They understand the plant and what it does, what other things don't do. And I think when you can really have a healthy balance between those two worlds, I think that's where you really create the magic solution. You know, there's companies that they're overly heavy on the business side, and they probably do things or make decisions that customers don't really appreciate. That usually would be over-skewing, maybe expensive products. Maybe they decide to remediate flower because it creates a better unit, and people, you know, customers and end users don't necessarily like those things. But if you're overly on the cannabis fan or lover side, you know, they may not be necessarily worried about cost or why do you need to create revenue and some of those decisions. So you really need a healthy balance between the two.
And help us understand more about Samson Extracts. Tell us who your customers are, why do they come to you, how are you differentiated from other hemp processors?
Yeah, and the big differentiation when you look across the scale of hemp processors is you have a large portion of the hemp processors take in extracts and then they do other things with them. So they might be taking CBD and then making CBD products with them for end user use. They might be taking our CBD and taking it into isolate. They may be taking CBD and then converting it into other cannabinoids. You know, that's very popular right now. So what we do and what our goal is we want to extract as much CBD as we can. And why it's differentiated, because like I said earlier, a large proportion of the processors in the industry, they just take the extract and do their thing with it. There's very few of us at high scale that are actually interacting with the plant of hemp itself, processing that, extracting it so that those downstream processors can be a beneficiary of it. So that's really what our big focus is on, is it's extracting as much CBD out of the plant as we can. And then we, the almost, I don't even say almost, 100% of our business is B2B transactions. So we really see ourselves in the position we're currently in as an ingredient supplier to other hemp processors. We do the dirty work so that they can do, you know, so they can do a little bit of the easier work. So and the differentiating factor is how large of equipment we use, how big of a scale we have. You know, if you go into a typical licensed marijuana extraction lab, you're probably talking 1,500 to 2,500 square feet, and all of the equipment fits into that one area, and they're able to do all of their processing. Well, for us, is we're, you know, just our main facility, we're close to 85,000 square feet, and we do extraction outside with large equipment that, for those that aren't familiar with the industry, it would look much more like you would see in an oil and gas midstream crude processing facility with very large towers, a lot of stainless steel, a lot of major motors, big pumps, things like that you wouldn't see in traditional cannabis extraction if you've been in those facilities. And so that's fun. It's very challenging, and it creates other issues, you know, because when you're in typical extraction, a lot of the equipment is plug and play. You plug it in, there's usually an instruction guide, a manual that goes with it, and you turn it on and it does its thing. Well, for us, because of our large scale, it's just not quite that easy. you know, a lot of the equipment that we're using here on site, whenever it was created or designed, extracting for cannabis was nowhere on the radar for that piece of equipment. So we're trying to take old equipment, not old equipment, but older designed equipment that wasn't intended for cannabis, and then actually using that to actually create our process at a much larger and higher scale.
Got it. So if I understand correctly what you said, there are very few that sort of take the plant and then process it, which is what you guys do. There are many more that will take what you've done, add other materials to it, and then sell it to potentially, you know, retailers, or maybe make products out of that for brands.
Yes. Yeah, that would be it. Yeah, they may even take our product and then they turn it into another ingredient for another product stream. So exactly, you're spot on. We are really working with the plant at high scale, but the large majority of processors actually use our inputs to further their processing.
And you guys recently came out with an announcement end of February saying that you process over 1 million pounds of hemp biomass in 2023. Help us understand, you know, when you go from hemp flower pounds down to biomass, like what's that ratio, right? So I'm referring to an MJ Biz Daily article that also recently came out saying California, for example, is a top producer of US hemp flowers. And in 2022, they process 6.3 million pounds.
So for us, it's a lot of times we're getting it as its biomass. And depending on when the states are collecting that data of when they collected their process, a lot of times whenever the farmer is finished with their harvesting, those are the pounds they're reporting. So it is likely that data that's being reported is probably post-harvest biomass. Now, the one big factor that you'll see is as hemp is growing and people are growing on acreage, that starts to expand. I mean, there's hemp operations we know of that grow beyond 1,500 acres of hemp, which is crazy. Where you would see loss from what you would see true pounds is depending on the level of mechanized harvesting that they're integrating with. So there are farms that are using, much like traditional farming, large combines, large harvesters to actually pull their hemp out of the field so that they can control their harvest costs. That is a big piece to the equation. But typically when we get it, it's in its biomass form. And for those that are growing CBD flower, if they're truly intending it to be extracted, every bit of their flower is going to be utilized within the biomass. And sometimes it's even more than that. You know, we have to be disciplined when we're speccing out our farmers for what they're growing, because sometimes you could get biomass where a farmer integrated a lot of stem into it, some stalk into it, and things like that, that of course harm our yields from a production perspective. But those numbers probably are truly biomass. And where the next piece goes into is how that farmer has a preference of processing that biomass to be sent out. We do see there isn't quite a great standard across the nation. For you have some farmers that will have it fully budded, maybe even still have it on stem. There's some farmers that might use a chop on it so that you can get your biomass to a more finer state, but not quite fine enough. And then you have some farmers that will completely mill the product into a small, not necessarily a powder, but a very small particle. And typically the reason you would want to do that is because you have more storage capability in super sack bags, so that your freight, you can put more pounds on a truck than you could if it was budded, because we know buds have air and other forms of mass in them. So if you ask what our preference was, we're probably somewhere in the middle of that. When you say biomass in the hemp industry, that kind of reflects the flower and everything that would be sent to us.
So that would make you guys probably the market leader then in terms of processing, especially with your stated goal for doing about 3 times that amount this year. So processing 3 million pounds of biomass.
Yeah, we certainly see ourselves in the top 10. I think there's an argument to be made that we're in the top 5. It's an industry that's tough because there isn't a lot of data on how many companies are processing and what poundage and things like that. A lot of our data collection is word of mouth, networking, you know, that type of stuff, because there are some benchmarkers in the industry, but they're only as good as the information they receive. And so we definitely are in the top 10. I believe that we're probably in the top 5, you know, but it's tough to fully confirm those numbers, but if you were to talk to people in the industry, they know that Samson Extracts is a serious mover when it comes to the processing of hemp.
And when you're competing with some of your, you know, top 10 players, how do you guys, I know you kind of mentioned to me your equipment and your process really helps you stand out, but from a consumer or I guess a customer standpoint, is it coming down to price or what other considerations for customers are there?
Well, you know, what's different about this is it kind of depends on what product you're putting out to the market. You know, there's major producers that focus on just processing crude and selling that out. There's major producers that want to make distillate and they'll send that out. And there's other producers that want to take it to Iceland and send that out. So sometimes you have a differentiator based on kind of what your target product that you're putting out on the ingredient side. Because when you're looking at who we see as our customers are, they have different processes or different intentions for what that product are. So we definitely see that. I will say that we at Samson is we play a volume game. We make a good product, a good quality product, but we definitely at this time not pounding the pavement that we're a high premium provider. And so you see some differentiation on that side with folks. So they'll make a super high potency CBD distillate. That's just not really in our game plan right now. For us, is that we make a good product in massive volume that a lot of people can use in very flexible ways. And that's I think that's really where we kind of see our from the differentiation side is this high volume and high scale. We you know, like we I think a lot of times in this industry. Especially when you look at brands on the retail side, there's a lot of claims about high premium and things like that. And if you're gonna say high premium, high quality, you better be there, or people will get frustrated. But we really are trying to not. I don't want to downgrade what our product is, but I think we really see ourselves as Costco, you know, Costco, Walmart when it comes to the products that we're putting out. And I think that's appropriate for us because we are shooting for high volume, and it's hard to track to super high quality and super high volume at the same time.
And what are you attributing to that growth? Is it customers wanting more hemp to be processed this year, or is it new customers? What's kind of that mix going from 1 million to 3 million pounds of hemp biomass that you'll process this year?
Yeah, well, the big one, if you ask me why we're continuing to increase, it's because we cannot fill our customer demands right now. We're manufacturing what we are at our capacity, and we could sell more. So when you looked at it at its core, that's the main reason why we are continuing to chase capacity. The other big one is that when I started at Samson in 22. There's a lot of equipment here and it just wasn't working correctly. It wasn't working appropriately. And so what we've really spent the last few years doing was re-engineering existing equipment, changing out some equipment that wasn't hitting spec. And really we've taken a lot of the equipment that's here on site and actually engineered it properly, rebuilt it. And we got scale just by making sure that the equipment could operate appropriately. So I wouldn't say that really we've been exchanging all this equipment out and changing all these things out and doing all these crazy projects. We certainly have done a lot of projects, but a lot of our projects have been to take the existing equipment and just making it work so that then that scale was created to where we got this 1 million pound mark. You know, when I started in 22, I think we hit 16,000 pounds a month. And we're a far cry away from that now, just by making sure that the equipment was engineered and built properly.
And after your customers buy your process hemp, what are they turning into? Like, give me an idea of, is it majority CPG products or some of it for building materials? Where are most of the inputs going?
Yeah, the CPG side is definitely the minimum right now. There isn't a tremendous amount of activity on that front. There was at one time, but I think that the CBD end user product, especially when it comes to ingestibles and edibles, I think it has been hit very hard by the introduction of psychoactive cannabinoids. So there isn't a large market for CBD end user products in comparison to the other ones. So I'd say that's very low in our revenue percentage of what we're currently doing. I would say the vast majority of people currently are taking our our CBD distillate, and they're turning it into CBD isolate. And that CBD isolate is being used for creating ratio products. If you want to do one-to-one THC, CBD, those things. But where we're hearing a lot of the activity right now is there's a large push for CBD isolate to go internationally. So there's a lot of international activity that's picking up for states that have newly, or sorry, for countries that have gotten more newly engaged with cannabis style products. And so there is a lot of international CBD isolate activity that's currently going on. We're hearing more about it every day, which is great. It's always great when U.S. products are being exported and used in other countries. Everyone wins in those scenarios. But that's where I'd say CBD isolate is the vast majority that's doing that. There's certainly a few customers that will take our products and they will use them for Delta 8 and some things like that. But I would say isolate is the vast majority.
And Samson's going into isolate in the summer, right?
Yes.
Currently, you're selling your distillate to customers who have been turning into isolate. If you are doing it yourself at Samson Extracts, does that mean you're competing with your customers, or is there enough demand that you're not really competing with customers?
No, I don't think we will. I think when we start isolate, I think that'll be a product mix. I think we would see a product mix occurring where we certainly would make some isolate. We would want to keep satisfying our previous distillate customers. So I think we will certainly make an isolate. But the other thing too is when we start our isolate process, there's going to be some adoption that happens internally where we're going to have to dial things in. It's probably not going to be perfect. It's probably not going to be the best scale. So in that moment, you know, as we're making isolate, just we may not have that capacity because we do have a large amount of capacity on distillate and just to be able to get product out, you know, we'll probably overcapacitate on our distillation system. So we will still sell distillate and things like that, but we'll certainly want to grow that isolate capability. But I think we'd certainly want to keep distillate in the factory so that we can satisfy existing customer bases.
And can you help us understand unit economics on that? Like, what are you selling, you know, whether it's in 1,000-pound increment or from a pricing perspective, what are you guys selling it for?
Well, we usually we sell our distillate in 55-gallon metal drums. A typical 55-gallon metal drum would make up about 200 kilos. So that's kind of what our unit size would be for the vast majority, is that we push it out in massive steel drums that's loaded, and then they would receive it in steel drums. And most of the businesses we work with have abilities to heat those metal drums up and then have the distillate move throughout.
And what happens with those steel drums? They just keep it, or do you guys take it and bring it back after your next delivery?
They keep them. We bake them into our cost. We bake them into our cost, and they keep them. And then they use it for whatever purpose they have. We did similar. It kind of works similar on the hemp side. You know, when we buy hemp from farmers, it comes in massive super sacks, and those are super sacks that, you know, we repurpose. So it's just a factor in the cost basis.
Got it. And then if, you know, 200,000 pounds is the equivalent of about 4,500 kilograms of distillate a month. You don't have to tell me the exact number, but what price range are you selling, you know, a kilogram at? Like, and I guess the bigger question, if you can reveal it, you know, whether it's a range or a number, is, you know, what sort of the scale of Samson from a revenue standpoint?
Yeah, so we've really been, you know, the market's changed really here these last 2 months, but we've sold distillate everything from $120 a kilo to upwards of 160. So we've kind of floated in that realm, I'd say, over time. At pricing, I would say here over the last month and a half, 2 months, has really been floating more in the 145 to 160 area, at least from what we've seen in the market.
Right. And there's like a industry benchmark that you guys use to track. So it's a bit more consistent than, let's say, cannabis in a certain state that has a lot more volatility, right?
Yeah, it is. And some of that's due too, is that a lot of times the hemp extracts are sold at volume as well. You know, if you look at flower pricing from a grower to a dispensary and things like that, those are usually smaller volumes, so that pricing can be very erratic, you know, based on whether it's THC quality level, or just the true quality of the bud. So you see a lot of volatility and flower pricing in the marijuana space because it's more small transactions. But we usually can hone in pretty good on the hemp side because there's so much, there's a lot of volume moving, a lot of bulk deals, and so it can, it seems to validate itself a little better.
Got it. That makes sense. Any other revenue streams for the company?
We are going to, here in the next 2 months, we are going to be launching a topicals-based retail line. We are strictly for topicals. It's hard, you know, to have just CBD products, like, as I mentioned earlier, in the edibles and ingestible space. So we will be looking at making some topical lines that are focused on after sun care, you know, lotions, things like that. We think that we have a good angle that we can make that work. So that would certainly be one that we'll be studying here over the next 6 months as we see that launch occur. But I'd say one of the cooler ones, from an innovation perspective, is a part of kind of our sister companies. We have a large farming network within kind of internally where we grow cotton, peanuts, corn, soybeans, things like that from the true agricultural perspective. And one thing we've seen is that our spent biomass actually works as a great pre-plant fertilizer. And so we are taking, right now, we've probably got upwards of 2 million pounds of spent biomass. And next week, we will be receiving a large industrial pelletizer. So after we've used our hemp from the extraction perspective, we are going to take our spent hemp and put that through a massive pelletizer and actually start creating a pre-plant fertilizer product for agricultural farms. Some of our testing showed that we were competing with, if not better than, some commercial pre-plant fertilizers. And so that's certainly an attractive revenue stream to an operator like me, because it's the old trash to treasure mentality. And, you know, for some reason we've kept it forever and now we have an opportunity to utilize it. So we'll sell that on a per pound basis to farms so that they actually use. And I think that's great. I think when you're in the hemp industry, a big focus is sustainability and not just creating more biomass trash, as you've seen articles about that in the industry. So we will actually be finding a way to take the hemp once we're done with it and send it back to Mother Earth, if you will.
And what else is in the future for Samson Extracts? I know you guys are very bullish on hemp. How do you guys view sort of the next 5 to 10 years in the hemp industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think specifically, I think our goal is for Samson Extracts is that we're running a large scale extraction business for decades to come. You know, I think that is totally in our flight plan. I don't think this isn't an operation we're running to be purchased or to sell off. I think we want this operation to run for a long time, and that's certainly the foundations we're building right now. But I would say we do have a sister entity, we're kind of within our ownership scope, where we are beginning the R&D on hemp fiber. We've tested out growing this past year, and we are looking at the hemp fiber piece very hard too. That wouldn't necessarily be in Samson Extract scope, but it'd certainly be a neighbor of ours, where we're growing our own hemp fiber. We're buying planted hemp fiber, and then we're turning that into things such as textiles or other usable products. But that's something we also are very serious about. You're starting to see a lot of very serious activity start to come through on that.
And help us understand Samson Extracts from a ownership perspective. You know, it seems like you came on as a CEO to sort of help improve what was there, but, you know, what was the original thesis for starting a hemp processor? You know, who's the investors in the business, and sort of are you guys profitable? Seems to be profitable.
Yeah, we are. We're solely funded by one individual. We are a debt-free enterprise. We are in the small county that entity is from. And really, I think there's a story about a few years back where, you know, we are in Alabama, but where there wasn't a, you know, before 2019 and the Farm Bill went through, there wasn't a huge attractiveness to start growing hemp, just because, you know, a lot of people didn't know what it was, and there's certainly mores and taboos associated with it. But the way we see hemp, I would say from our side and why we're in it, is we farm a number of crops. We have cattle, We are very, very hardcore in the agricultural space here in South Alabama and the Panhandle. We have upwards of over 20,000 acres of productive land for those purposes. And for us, which is going to be a little different than the way you see in the industry, but hemp for us is we see as a great crop diversifier. And especially hemp extraction, it helps diversify our agricultural capabilities. So anytime you can bolster other crops into each other and diversify that mix, that certainly protects you from an agricultural perspective. So if corn has a down year or if cotton has an up year, you know, those types of variables, we see hemp as a very nice fit into that. So if hemp is doing well, it actually can help protect other crop types and so forth.
Do you see a lot of other farms having that same perspective, whether, you know, up to this point, or you think in the next few years we'll also start growing hemp in terms of diversifying, like you mentioned?
Yeah, I've seen some. I've definitely seen, we work, like, for instance, we work with growers that also grow other products or other types of crops and so forth. I think it's hard to have an increased adoption in it because with farmers, you know, a lot of times generations before them grew a crop type and then their parents grew a crop type and they're growing that same crop type. So it's the only thing they ever knew. It's the only thing they ever really knew about. So sometimes growing a new crop when you've been doing something for 60 or 70 years, you know, I think it's a tough hill to climb because it's very predictable to grow their existing crop bases. But, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, 2019 and 2020 did a lot of damage from the farmer's perspective. You know, that's when that market was really climbing. There's a lot of farmers all throughout the nation. I mean, if you took a survey of hemp farmers during that time, you would have a very negative downward sentiment on growing hemp. So that certainly creates a lot of issues, and we encounter that sentiment weekly. You know, as we're looking for farmers to grow for us, they always talk about 19 and 20 because a lot of these farmers thought they were going to be overnight millionaires from growing hemp. And as you saw, what happened is thousands and thousands and thousands of people started growing hemp, created a massive supply that outpaced the demand for the market, and a lot of people lost their shirts. A lot of people lost their shirts, kind of a minor day gold rush, if you will. But it there's a lot of burn, I think, for new adoption into growing hemp because when people tried it before, it just didn't go well for them. And it may not even be a market factor that created that. That certainly is the large part of it. But a lot of people went into growing hemp thinking it was going to be very similar to growing corn or growing cotton, and they weren't prepared for, one, the infrastructural need that there was for growing hemp when you're talking about drying and storage, irrigation, those things. But they also weren't prepared for how cumbersome the harvest is. You know, it really, there's not the people that are doing mechanized harvesting really well. There's very few of them. So a lot of hemp is actually harvested very manually, you know, people cutting plants down, dragging the plants to the barn, hang drying it. So I think that really caught a lot of people off guard with how high maintenance it would be to grow and harvest hemp.
Yeah, I kind of imagine that it wouldn't be that easy to just pick it up and say, yeah, this looks good. Like, we'll start doing it, right? You need to bring in people like yourself with background in doing it somewhere else, whether that's on the cannabis or hemp side. And yeah, it's harder for them to start themselves if they've never done it or don't have someone in-house that knows how.
Yeah, no, it's certainly that. I mean, you saw a lot of people do it. Now there is some integration you've seen that's been a little smoother, right? Is folks that are familiar with growing tobacco and stuff like that, it was a much easier integration. It's a very similar plant. It needs very similar infrastructure. So if people were doing agriculture that was similar, that was a lot easier for them. But I will say there's a lot of people that thought it was going to be a one-to-one match with existing crop types.
Yeah, because I've definitely seen more on the cannabis side, people who've grown, you know, peppers or tomatoes that now just say, hey, we can grow cannabis too. Obviously, we just have to get the licenses to do so. But you're saying from a hemp perspective, cotton's probably the easier thing to convert to hemp from.
Yeah, I think especially if you've been doing something similar to it. If you've been doing something similar to it, I think it transfers very nicely. And some of it too, as well, is like there's other easier ways to grow hemp where, you know, a lot of people went out and blew out a ton of acreage doing it, but you can have a lot of success in existing greenhouses as well. It's way more, way easier, manageable. It's usually lower amounts, but you see a lot of people really starting off in greenhouses before they push out the heavy acreage. But if you're used to a crop type that has heavy maintenance, it's definitely an easier transfer of skills.
Got it. And so would you then imagine more folks in like North Carolina potentially growing hemp, or, and I actually don't even know if, you know, tobacco and whatnot is still very lucrative for them. So would you see some of those states convert more and compete with, you know, Alabama and yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that you see that there's not a ton of tobacco grown in Alabama. It's actually pretty hard to grow hemp in where we're at in Alabama because we deal with a sandier soil, and for a cannabis plant to carriage really well, it needs a very good, strong root system. And that can be difficult in sandy style soil. But I think you see a lot of existing tobacco farmers growing hemp in Kentucky, because, as you said, the tobacco industry isn't as great as it used to be for a number of reasons. And I think you see that in North Carolina. There is a lot of North Carolina is known to have a good amount of hemp grown there. And there's a lot of very good hemp processors in North Carolina as well. So I do think that you see that transfer really well.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I know like tobacco from just, you know, a usage standpoint is going down, but certainly the prices always seem to increase. And, you know, while there may be less consumers, the revenue may be there just because of pricing. But yeah, if you're a forward looking farm, you may be switching over to hemp to sort of get an earlier start on the decline.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think you're seeing that transfer. I think there's a lot of people that are really kind of are a bit over the tobacco industry, and they're looking for new ways to do it. And there's certainly people that need hemp grown. And as long as the biggest thing there to get the farmers to move over is that the industry has to create confidence again that if farmers grow something and you contract with that farmer, is that they will be paid for their crop. And that's the biggest concern by far, 100%, that those farmers have, is that when they grew all that hemp in 19 and 20, they had commitments from large companies, they had contracts from large companies, and when time came and the plant was harvested, those companies faded into the mist. And so then they're sitting on large amounts of hemp and trying to figure out what they're going to do with it. We've seen that over the last 2 years, is a lot of the hemp that was out in the market in the last 2 years was grown in 2019, grown in 20, grown in 2021. And a lot of that times when that stuff's sitting there, it was due to contracts being executed and they just didn't come through the way that the farmer had intended to from an expectations management perspective.
And on that point, are forward contracts becoming a thing in the industry?
They are. I would say it's the large core now. We've seen that a lot of the supplies of hemp that were grown that was in surplus, a lot of that has been purchased in the last 2 years, and there just isn't a lot of that hemp still sitting around for spot buys. That market has gotten far smaller. If there is still a heavy market for spot buying, the prices are usually pretty high and don't necessarily match up with quality and what the farmer is looking for. And now, I would say from our perspective is we are majority looking at forward contracting versus spot buying. And it was the complete opposite the last 2 years. We were more spot buying than we were farming. But this year, we flipped the ratio to more farming and less spot buying.
And are those forward contracts more like 1 year? So you still have to be a believer long-term in the longevity of the hemp industry?
I think so. I think so. I think one of it is the one piece is we have a number of farmers this year that are growing for us for the first time. And they want to make sure the whole thing's real. So, you know, there's a lot of one-year contracts we have this year. We have farmers that we would have confidence in having potentially multi-year contracts with. But I think not only is it that what the hemp industry is going to do, but it is difficult to do multi-year contracts right now strictly from the price basis. The price basis on a price per point of hemp per pound is kind of rapidly changing. You know, if we go back to 2022, a good deal would have been probably 14 to 15 cents per point of hemp. If you go back to last year, the market 18 to 21 cents per point on hemp. And this year, the market's anywhere from probably 20, 24. In some spot buy cases, you could get north of 35 cents a point on spot buys. But that 35 cents is really far too high, I think, for most operators to play ball with. So, but for this year, I'd say you're really looking at a market that's probably more 24 to 28 cents per point on a pound of hemp. And what I mean by price per point is you take, you essentially multiply, let's say that 24 cents by what the potency would be. So 10% hemp at 24 cents a point would be 240 a pound, kind of in that example. And so we still feel, and what we've seen from benchmarkers is the market's really at that 24 cents a point for hemp, but there are certainly people that are trying to get far more than that. And I just don't think the market's quite there yet.
Yeah. So given that there's some, you know, I think for me, at least from my viewpoint, that's a major infrastructure improvement, that along with sort of just more demand now for hemp and, you know, for distillate and for isolate and internationally, it seems like hemp is more on the up and up. And there's some long-term structural value in it, you know, being a real lucrative industry. Is there anything else that we may have missed that points to sort of, you know, hemp just being on the up to the right trajectory at this point in time?
Yeah, I mean, really, I think the thing that has surprised a lot of people, and you've seen it a lot in the news, is the I'd say the explosion of hemp-derived Delta 9 drinks. They're spec to a certain Delta 9 THC level, and that stuff is getting really major market that wasn't really around a year ago. The drinks are getting very popular, so popular that, you know, there's been a lot of talk and articles about Total Wine and Wines and Spirits, the large multi liquor mart chain that's across the country. Is I read an article the other day that they have 228 locations in 26 states that are now displaying hemp derived Delta 9 drinks, just as they would display bourbon whiskey. Those types of moves create massive, massive, massive market waves, because then if you have a large company at that size and scale that Total Wines and Spirits is, people are going to start moving into the market more, right? It creates legitimacy. It will begin to create competition, and people will begin to enter. And you've seen that. Now there are a lot of drinks being sold, a lot of hemp-derived Delta 9 drinks being manufactured. You're even seeing a transfer, you know, if you went back a year ago when the hemp-derived, well, 2 years ago, when you saw the hemp-derived Delta 9 stuff really coming, a lot of more marijuana-focused brands were against it because that was harming their ability to sell their products inside of their regulated state lines. But now you're seeing that they have now said, if you can't beat them, join them. So you see massive marijuana brands now making hemp-derived Delta 9 products so that they can compete in the space. So I think this is a large piece of what's driving a lot of the activity in hemp currently, because I think there are major market movers and major market players that are now embracing hemp rather than being mad about hemp. And that's creating an absolute crazy amount of demand that we're currently seeing right now.
Yeah, and I think recently even Specs in Texas, which has, you know, 100 plus stores, they've also taken on hemp beverages. And of course, you've seen Anheuser-Busch distributors now adding in certain states, especially where there's maybe not an adult use program and maybe even not a medical program. You're seeing a lot of these distributors legitimize it. So yeah, I think that happening in some of these states where you're also seeing a lot of the hemp farmers come from, that alignment sort of makes sense to have this be more of a long-term play rather than what we saw with the Farm Bill initially in 2018.
Yeah, no, and I used to go to the Specs in Dallas all the time, so I am familiar with Specs, and that is funny that they're starting to do it. But what I'll say though is I think from my perspective, the hemp-derived Delta 9 drinks companies, the really serious players, are doing it very smartly. They're creating products that are low dose, 5 milligrams, 10 milligrams, some are 2.5 milligrams of Delta 9 THC. And I think they're being very responsible. And my guess is the large brands like Total Wines and Spirits are working with folks that are being responsible with that. And so I think that's a good trend when you're looking at new product into adoption and you're creating a new customer base, is that they're creating products that are low dose and they're very predictable. You know, I think if it was the other way around, where people were making drinks that were 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams, I think that it's a much different conversation. But I think they're going about it a very smart way, and I think they're using a heavy degree of product responsibility by doing that.
Yeah, I think that that sort of conversion of low dose is more similar to folks drinking alcohol, right? A 100 milligram can is not similar to drinking a can of beer. So if you're low dose at 2 milligrams, that's more comparable. Last question for you, since you're in Alabama and we're talking about hemp D9 beverages, what's sort of the landscape there in Alabama? Are you seeing a lot of C-stores and shops carry it?
Yeah, you are. You do see CBD stores carry it. You do see the C-stores, gas stations. You know, they do have some of those products. So they are here. The state of Alabama did put in regulation the past year for over 21 sales and to have responsible packaging. And that's really what you need, right? Is, you know, I think having access to the product is huge, because I think it creates an avenue for people to access the product. I think that's great, but it does need to be done responsibly. I think that's responsible regulation to make sure that it's being intended for users over the age of 21. And also that packaging and things like that aren't appealing to minors or children in those cases. So I think those are responsible. I think that's very responsible regulation. But yes, you do see those products here in the state.